Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
I'm Frank Avignon. It's great to be with all of you and to see all of you as well. Many of you, of course, know my story from the book and the movie and the Broadway musical. Most people just know that part about my life. They don't know that I've worked with the FBI for 46 years, for over four decades. I've trained two generations of FBI agents. My oldest son is an FBI agent. He's been in the Bureau 17 years. I'm married to my wife and one and only wife for 45 years, have seven grandchildren, three sons. And of course, my life to me is not so much amazing about what I did between 16 and 21, which is what most people know. But the fact that I did it, went to prison in three countries, served my time, and eventually was able to turn my life around, find someone who loved me, get married and have children, and brought my life to where my life is today. So today, it's most important to me about the things that I've done after that, but I'm going to take your questions and you can ask me any question that you would like to ask, no matter what that question's about.
Absolutely. So we have a question from one of the students here in the United States. They want to know, in the film Catch Me If You Can, in your opinion, does that represent the time when you were pursued by the FBI? Is that an accurate representation?
I think that Steven Spielberg did a great job of trying to stay as close to the story as he could. He loved the redemption side of the story. He loved what happened to my life after that. He wanted the world to know that. I think he tried to stay it in the era it actually took place, which was in the late 1960s, early 70s. And I thought he did a great job of telling the story. Obviously, he has to change things because it's telling someone's five-year life in 2.5 hours of film. So some things he changed around, but most of all, I thought he stayed as close to the story as he could. He had never made a real movie about a real person living. And so to him, that was also an experiment for him to do that for the first time. And so I was very pleased with the outcome of the film.
That's very interesting, the representation about how much research probably went into that. But what's even more amazing is the life after that. And I know that we were talking about that when we were waiting for the kids to jump on. We have a question from Emma. And Emma, I believe, is in Italy. Emma, you should be able to unmute to ask your questions.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Emma.
Hi, I want to ask, which was the most challenging fraud that you have to program, and which one the most difficult to find out and solve?
Which one was the most difficult for me to do when I was doing the things I did?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably I thought was the doctor. I knew I could only fake that so far. And so I avoided a lot of things. I think the lawyer part of it was just really understanding, like any good lawyer, how to read people and understand how to express yourself and bring your point across. And of course, posing as a pilot, you know, I never actually flew the planes. I was 16, 17 years old at the time. I was just riding around in those planes, sitting in the cockpit as a jump pilot. And so I didn't have to do anything or take over any controls. So I guess looking back, the most difficult part was probably the short period of time trying to pose as a doctor.
That is, and you know, there was a one thing that wasn't in the movie that I was kind of intrigued about was, is it true that you were also a professor at one point?
Yeah, that's simply when I was in Utah, I met some people that went to Brigham Young University, and they were looking for someone to teach a sociology class, and I had told them that I had a degree in sociology. And so basically, I just spent a summer semester kind of teaching in a class as a summer teacher, but I was basically reading one chapter ahead of my students. So I wasn't as smart as they thought I was. I was just smart enough to read further along than they were reading.
That's great. So you're just like a TA. So we have Nathan, and Nathan has a really good question. He's in France. Nathan, you can ask your question.
Good morning. The question I wanted to ask is, do you think you could have done what you did nowadays with modern technologies?
I think it's 4,000 times easier to do today than what I did 50 years ago. That's because I didn't have all the technology. You know, technology breeds crime. It always has and it always will. There will always be criminals who use technology in a self-serving way. So, you know, back in the old days to print checks, you literally had to learn how to operate a printing press. There were color separations, negatives and plates and typesetting. Today, you just open up a laptop and you bring a diagram of a check up and you go to a company's website and you capture their logo. You go to the bank, capture their logo. You fill in all the blanks on the check. And in 15 minutes, you have a beautiful four color check and you run it off on your inkjet printer. These things didn't exist back then. And I think the same goes for social engineering. Back then, the only way that I could talk to people and get them to give me information was over a telephone. That was the only form of communication. Today, of course, there's text messages, there's emails, there's the internet. So I think really it has made it much easier to do than the things I did 50 years ago.
That's very, very interesting stuff. And we have a child, individual, Ruben. Ruben, you should be able to unmute. You had a question and Ruben is in Spain. Ruben, go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, good afternoon. I would like to tell you, which was the most challenging situation in your life?
Probably is still the same today as it was many years ago. You know, I always remind people that people always say, what turned your life around? And I think they'd like you to say that you were born again, you saw the light, prison rehabilitated you. But I don't think that I was any different the person who went into prison, who came out of prison. What turned my life around is that I met my wife 45 years ago, didn't have a dime to my name. I was on parole and I basically fell in love with her and I asked her to marry me. And against the wishes of her parents, she did. And she basically changed my life. She turned my life around. She believed in me, she trusted me, she loved me, she gave me the support I needed. And everything I have today, everything I've achieved today, who I am today, is because of the love of my wife. And I think that's the most important thing that turned my life around.
That's wonderful. We have a question from Mario, and Mario is in Italy. You should be able to unmute. You had a good question, sir.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Abagnale. Pleased to meet you. Hi. I have a question about your second life. I was curious, who had the idea? It was yourself or the bureau?
Had my idea about
working for the FBI.
Working for the FBI. And
oh, yes. No, that was part of my parole. The government said they were willing to take me out of prison. I had already served a little over 3 years of my 12-year sentence. And they said they were willing to take me out of prison if I would go and work with the FBI, only for the period of time of my parole. When my parole was over, I would have no further obligation to the government and I was free to go. I decided on my own to stay and I've stayed there now for more than 46 years. I truly am honored to be able to do that. And the things that I've been able to do with my life and the things that I've been able to teach the agents. And so I wanted to stay, that choice was mine. I didn't have to stay after my time was over, which so probably about, probably almost now 40 years that obligation was over, but I continued to do that even past that time.
One of the kids in the United States wanted to know, could you kind of explain the process of how someone becomes an FBI agent?
It's very difficult. In the United States, the FBI hires one in every 10,000 applicants to become an FBI agent. Most of them have law degrees and have graduated and passed the bar in a state. Many of them are CPAs and are accountants. Some have expertise in computers. Some have expertise in bombing. A lot of them come from the military. The average age of an agent going into the FBI Academy is usually around 28, 29 years old. So they have some work experience, have either been with the police department somewhere and have come from the former police, or they've come from the military police, or they have some kind of unique background that when they apply to the FBI. So My son was kind of an exception. It was amazing to me that my son ever got in. It had absolutely nothing to do with me. But since he was 14, that's what he wanted to do. So he went to college, graduated, went to law school, graduated from law school, took the bar, passed the bar, and then went on to apply to the FBI. And he's been in about 17 years now, and he runs the FBI's Crisis Negotiations Unit. That's a unit that handles kidnappings where they're involved, ransom, no matter where they take place around the world. So he has a very interesting job, but he had a goal in life and he followed through with it. I never thought he'd be able to do it, but he did it.
And we thank you and your son for the service to our country. And I got to say, that must have been a weird first day of work for you, having been a criminal, and then all of a sudden you're on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, and you have to understand that when that happened, there were no women, there were no minorities, it was all white men. And basically, they didn't like the idea that I was there. So then the director, who was the head of the FBI back then, thought it would be a great idea if I taught at the academy. This way, when agents came in on their first day and had to go through school, they go for about 20 weeks, that they would get to know who I was. And that was one of the best ideas. So over time, I got well accepted. And of course, so many of now, two generations later, I have retired, and I've had great relationships with all of them, including the FBI agent who chased me around the world. He and I were friends for almost 30 years until he passed away, and I dedicated one of my books to him called Stealing Your Life. He was a wonderful man and a mentor to me, and probably has a lot to do with my career.
That's a wonderful friendship, Blossom. We'll go with two more questions, and then we'll let you go. This comes from Jackie, and Jackie is in France. Jackie, go ahead. You can unmute yourself to ask.
Hi. Was it like a game to trick the USA when you were on the run?
Would you, Ralph?
She wants to know, was it when you were younger doing it, because obviously you're in your late teens, was it kind of like a game to just play with them?
How it started out was basically my parents got divorced. I was asked in a court which parent to choose. I didn't want to make that choice. So at 16, I ran away from home. Now, in the late 1960s, a lot of kids who ran away from home got into Haight-Ashbury, the hippie scene, the drug scene. I ended up on the streets of New York City. I was 16 years old. And the first thing I thought to myself, I'm going to have to get creative to survive. So I looked older than 16. So I altered my driver's license, which back then didn't have a photo on it. It was an IBM card. I was born in 1948, so I dropped the 4, made it a 3. And that made me 10 years older, or 26 years old. And then, of course, I started writing checks. First, I had money in the account, then the money ran out. So it started out more as a way to survive. Then people started chasing you. So it became more of, how do I stay ahead of these people that are chasing me? And eventually, towards the end of it all, I was starting to be more of a game. But I always, always knew I'd get caught. And I'm not as smart as people thought I was. The fact is, I was an adolescent. And because I was young, I had no fear. I had no fear of getting caught. I had no fear of consequences. And I didn't premeditate anything. I didn't sit outside a bank with a check and say to myself, I'm going to go in and say this. If they say this, then I'll do this. I just did it. And I think if I had been a little older, maybe I'd been 23, I would have never done half the things I did, because I would have rationalized and said, you'll never get away with it. It's impossible. But because I was so young, I think that was the main reason that I got away with so many of the things I got away with.
It's an astonishing story. We have Lydia, who is in Spain. Lydia, go ahead and ask your question, and then we'll have our final question with Mev in Italy.
All right, first of all, hello, I'm so excited. And my question is, what is a moral or conclusion you take from many experiences and moments you have lived?
Well, you know, the biggest thing I take away is this, that when you make a mistake in your life, you have to live with that mistake. And there, unfortunately, are people who will always remember what you did. There are people who will not forgive you for what you did, even though it's 50 years ago and you didn't physically harm anybody, you didn't use a gun, you didn't hurt anybody. They look at you as a former criminal. And I'd have to live with that every day of my life. So yes, there's a lot of people who admire what I've done with my life, but there's also people who still really don't feel redemption is something that they want to accept. And they look at you as a former criminal. So I always remind people, when you make a mistake in your life, you have to live with that the rest of your life. And you know, someone from my generation may live to be 80 or 90 years old, but someone from your generation will live to be well over 100 years old. So you have to say to yourself, if I do something, do I want to have to live with that the rest of my life? And that goes for a lot of things, how you treat other people, if you're a bully to someone, if you mistreat someone, if you lie and deceptive to someone. At the time, you think nothing of it. But as life goes on and you get a little older, you start to think about those things and they start to weigh on you and you start to feel a lot of guilt about it. And that's something I would wish on no one. So before you do anything, before you ever act, you always have to ask yourself, is this worth doing? Is what harm does this cause someone else? And do I want to live with this the rest of my life? And if you stop and think a few seconds, you probably won't do it.
That's sound advice. We have our final student question. This is Mev, and she is in Italy. Mev, you should be able to unmute and ask.
Hello, hi, nice to meet you.
Hi.
I would like to know, if you had to choose any special event in your life, what would you absolutely like to relieve or to change it, or because you like it so much, but which one would it be?
No, you know, I worked when I, that's a great question. When I worked for the FBI coming out of prison, they did not pay me. So I had to have a job. So my first job was at a pizza inn making pizza. They found out about my record and they fired me. So then I got a job driving a bus between downtown and the airport. They found out about my record and they fired me. Then I got a job working in a grocery store, stocking groceries on the midnight to eight shift in the morning. And then they wanted to make me a manager and put me in a training program. When they did, they found out about my record and they fired me. When I look back on my life now, I think that had I been more transparent, had I simply said to the employer, look, I've been in prison. This is what I did. This is what I'm trying to do with my life. I'm looking for an opportunity. Probably my life would have been a lot different. And to be honest with you, every day I say to myself, I wish I was in that grocery store. I wish I did become a manager of that grocery store and lived my life in a quiet, simple life, raising my three sons, having my wife, my seven grandchildren in a small house somewhere, then the life I have today is totally different than that. I accept the life I have today, but the truth is, I think I would have been a much happier man had I just stayed working in that grocery store and no one knew who I was.
That's sound advice. And for all of our students and all of our teachers and anyone on here, we have a lot of great guest speakers coming up next week. Be sure to check it out in the link in the chat. And then one final thing, Frank, before we let you go, as these kids go off into the world and figure out what they want to do, is there any advice that you can impart on them as they kind of figure out which path they want to go on?
Absolutely. I can't think of anything better to do than start learning about cybercrime, ransomware, malware. And that just doesn't mean taking a computer class where you learn how to write code. This is talking about cybercrime because that's where the future is. They're looking for more than 500,000 people in this country alone to start working in that industry of cybercrime. And cybercrime's not going anywhere. It's only going to get worse. And so anyone that's young and gets into developing and working and understanding and becoming a cybercrime expert for their company or dealing with those types of crimes, that's where I think they have a great, great future.
That's great advice. All right, guys, before I end the meeting for all, before I close the meeting, I'm going to ask everyone to unmute. And can we all say thank you to Frank for spending time with us today?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.